Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. In sickness and in health, perhaps you are one of the many who's vowed to stand by your partner on both sides of this promise. But like so many things in marriage, it's easier said than done. Eric Gumney and his wife Monica know this all too well. Chris Messina of The Mindy Project and the film The Sweet Life reads Eric's essay, When Love Isn't As Simple as Standing By Your Man.
My wife and I used to joke about how much better we were than other couples. How we never had the petty fights and misunderstandings that everyone else seemed to be having. Together, we had weathered layoffs, a cross-country move, multiple hospitalizations for my cystic fibrosis, and the housebreaking of two terrier puppies. Yet somehow we always managed to come out stronger than before. Our love was indestructible. Then she threatened to leave me 6 weeks after I had a double lung transplant. When you're being evaluated for a transplant, there are a lot of things the nurses and medical professionals tell you over and over again to drive home the significance, to make sure you're truly prepared, and probably to keep you from suing them later. There's a good chance you may die, they tell you, either during the surgery or while waiting for it. They show you pictures of how physically racked your body's going to be in the days after the procedure. They give you documents explaining that you may die, what the cost of prescriptions will be, and how high the risk of death is. They explain that you're going to be allergic to grapefruit and turtles afterward. For a while, you won't be able to lift anything heavier than a gallon of milk. And, oh yeah, death is a distinct possibility. There are also a lot of things the medical professionals don't mention. The stench of stale milk emanating from the nutritional supplements stacked in a corner of your rented bedroom. The wild mood swings, the muscle spasms. The sound an oxygen tank makes when a valve breaks at 2 a.m. Like the inside of a tornado. And what it feels like when antibiotics turn your colon into a water slide. None of the pamphlets mention the psychological toll of waiting to die or of waiting for, even grimly rooting for, someone else to die so that you can get that person's lungs. They don't explain how not to feel like a monster about that. No one tells you that the physical scars are the easy ones. My wife, Monica, knows this all intimately now, better even than I do. While I was high on anti-anxiety medications and cannabis-based appetite stimulants, she was the one who had to remain clear-headed enough to clean up after me and keep us rolling in buckets of expensive prescriptions. She didn't have the luxury of mentally checking out the way I did. She would spend her mornings dealing with the gruesome symptoms of my death spiral, and then spend the afternoons trying to do her day job from my hospital room. Monica and I bought a home in Albuquerque about 6 months before my lungs decided they no longer wanted to be lungs. There is nowhere in New Mexico where you can get a lung transplant, legally or otherwise. The local cystic fibrosis clinic worked in tandem with the transplant team at Stanford Hospital in California, summoning information and x-rays, and then, when things really went off the rails, moving me via emergency airlift. Monica spent the first 2 weeks sleeping on a cot in my tiny hospital room, both because I was a disaster and because she didn't have anywhere else to go. In between consoling me and checking in with the doctors and corralling the parents and coordinating with our friends to drive our car and all our stuff out west, Monica also had to find us a cheap apartment in one of the most expensive markets in the world before I could be even tenuously released from the hospital. We had to stay within an hour of Stanford Hospital. I wasn't going to be allowed to go back to Albuquerque unless I became significantly less almost dead. Bills began piling higher on our makeshift dining room table, a rickety card table from IKEA. Monica kept working, fundraising, and taking care of me. 2 months later, I was on 6 liters of oxygen while sitting still. I could barely eat. 3 months after that, my wife was bathing me like a child as I shivered and huddled in the tub trying not to have a panic attack. Monica had known about the cystic fibrosis since our third date, about the possibility of a transplant since shortly after. We had made it through some rough exacerbations and pneumonias before, argued with insurance companies and hospitals. We thought we could handle anything that the transplant could throw at us. All the papers and preparation in the world, though, can't get you ready for how radically life-altering the transplant process is. How fundamentally less than human you become while waiting and wasting away. No brochure explains what that does to those watching you. 7 months after arriving in Palo Alto, we finally received the call. An organ donor of the correct size and blood type, within an acceptable distance for rapid transport, had died. And I received my double lung transplant. A 9-hour procedure that went well. Within a week of surgery, I was out of the hospital and back in our apartment with only Tylenol for the pain. We had the respiratory therapy company collect the oxygen tanks and tubes. We tossed all the nutritional supplements. Things were finally getting back to normal. Except we still couldn't go home. We needed to stay near Stanford Hospital for at least 3 more months. I still couldn't walk. My leg muscles had atrophied from the months of failing lung capacity and bed rest. And my new lungs still needed to be broken in. I needed physical therapy to learn to breathe again, to function as a human being. I was still only half a person. I don't think I could do this anymore, Monica said. Monica was a teary, snotty mess the night she blindsided me with the news that she may have to leave me if I didn't get healthier, faster. It was mid-October, less than 2 months after the transplant. I was more terrified in that moment than I had been at any time during my hospitalizations or at any time they had to cut me open. The world itself seemed to stop. Despite the 20 pounds I had gained, the 6'2" frame I had finally filled, I felt small and helpless. She was towering over me, crying, sniffling, trying to explain. She had already bought a plane ticket home. I was wearing new pajamas. I had a pile of pills on the table. A window open to the street at my back. I could hear the cars at the light braking, stopping, going. After my mother flew in to relieve her, Monica left for New Mexico. I spent those next days and weeks feeling wounded, incensed. I tried to distract myself by building a haunted gingerbread house for Halloween, but couldn't help dwelling on Monica's betrayal. How could she? I ranted to myself, smoldering. Who does something like that? I fumed as I applied icing to the roof. Do I have to wait until Halloween to eat this? I was still on a lot of drugs at that point, and it was hard to stay focused. Monica and I didn't talk much while she was gone. Once I knew she was coming back, though, I began deciding what I was going to say to her, how I was going to explain how hurt and upset I was that she would simply abandon me after everything I had gone through. And there it was. I hadn't gone through anything. We had. Together. Every problem my waning health presented, Monica had to handle twice over, worrying about me and worrying about her life after me if it all went sideways. Every time someone told me I was going to die, she had to sit there, silently, taking it in. I could shrug off all the dire news and flip to the Cartoon Network, but she didn't have that option. She had to deal with the information, the issues, and the repercussions. Acting as a nursemaid, housekeeper, chauffeur, and lawyer for me, the man who was supposed to share her life, not consume it. I don't think I can do this anymore. Her words haunted me for weeks. But I was wrong about them. They weren't an ultimatum. They were a proclamation of defeat. Monica needed a break from doing the impossible. Her hasty retreat didn't mean she was done with me. It meant she was as broken as I was. My wife and I don't joke about how great we are anymore. We realize now how precarious, how fragile a claim like that really is. Our love may be indestructible, but we sure as hell aren't.
Chris Messina, reading Eric Gumney's essay, When Love Isn't As Simple as Standing By Your Man. It's been almost 3 years since Eric's double lung transplant. We'll hear how he's doing today after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Nearly 3 years after his double lung transplant, Eric Gumney is in good health. But he told us that the physical scars are healing faster than the emotional ones.
Somebody did have to die for me to be alive, and that is a really heavy burden and a responsibility. And if you think about that, it's kind of hard to just take in your day-to-day life where you're making money and paying your mortgage and just living your life. I get kind of like a heavier feeling, almost a little bit of depression just thinking about it. So it is just kind of a way to keep moving forward. I kind of don't think about it as often as maybe I used to.
Eric and Monica are still married, and they went to the studio together for this conversation. Monica told us about the beginning of their relationship before she had any idea what she was getting into.
So when I first met him, I just thought he had maybe a little bit of a cold, maybe some allergies. He would cough sometimes. He did tell me, I think, third date, and it was pretty shocking. But I basically kept waiting for him to screw up for other reasons so I wouldn't have to deal with it. I was like, he'll be a terrible guy at some point, and it'll be way better than being like a jerk who breaks up with some guy. So that was my plan, and then he kept being awesome, so it didn't work.
But of course, Monica did leave at one point, but just for 2 weeks.
I know I needed a break. I knew that I was frustrated and feeling a bit abandoned myself. He hadn't been himself in so long, and I was out of whatever reserves I had left, and he was well enough that I felt okay to leave.
Monica had no idea that Eric thought she was leaving for good.
You know, when she was reading one of the drafts, she was like, what are you talking about? That's not how I saw that at all. That's not what happened. And then so we finally just kind of sat down, like, wait, what did you think was happening? And so she explained it. And I was like, oh yeah, that makes a lot more sense. And it's not nearly as terrible as what I thought it was. But it just wasn't a conversation we had until, you know, a year and a half later or something like that.
The more I kind of reflect on it, I realized that while I was in New Mexico, I had an inkling that this mattered a whole heck of a lot more to him, that I was away and having fun and he wasn't. I'm not talking, I was partying. I'm talking, I went to the park with my dog and it was the best day. Like, and the simple, simple stuff. So I didn't know he felt that way. And if I did on any level, honestly, I couldn't take on any more of his pain. I needed to go away and like recharge and not be worried about him, because I'd been worried continuously for most of a year.
Monica isn't alone. After Eric's essay was published, he heard from many people who had been in Monica's situation. They understood her need for a break. Eric also heard from a hospital that wanted to start a caregiver support group in response to his essay.
A few social workers reached out, like, thank you for bringing that up. We really need to be better about making sure caregivers are taken care of, making sure they're not overworked and, you know, overtaxed like that. So I think that was a really good benefit of the essay coming out that we weren't really anticipating in any fashion at all.
Eric is currently working on a novel about his transplant. He and Monica still live in Albuquerque, and with Eric's illness at bay, they're able to focus on some of their other goals.
I mean, it's back to little things, like we want to get a new washer and dryer. Like, you know, like that's our big goal, to save up some money to maybe redo the kitchen. It's nothing major. We're just kind of enjoying it because it's nice to not have to worry about oh, we need 60 grand for a transplant, or like, we need to make sure we have 10 grand in reserve in case we have to fly out to Stanford on like a medevac. It's really just nice to have little, smaller, reasonable goals, and we're just kind of enjoying that.
I'm going to get him on a horse. That's another goal. He's never done that.
Eric Gumney and his wife, Monica Rodriguez. Thanks to Chris Messina, who read this week's story. He told us about his own connection to Eric's experience.
Well, unfortunately, I had a friend that I went to college with that had lung complications and died. And so when I read this story, I thought of my time with him, and I thought of all his struggles that he told me about. So the story spoke to me.
Chris Messina. He plays Danny on Hulu's The Mindy Project, and he stars in the film The Sweet Life. It's available online and on demand. Coming up, we'll hear Daniel Jones' take on what it means to stand by your partner.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Few know better than Daniel Jones, the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, just how easy it is to underestimate the gravity of the vows we make to our partners.
I think when we're looking forward to marriage and we're thinking about it in these idealistic ways, it's really helpful to read stories like this and understand that you don't always have to be at your best. You can be weak at times. In fact, at my own wedding, my wife and I had several poems read, and one was about, described marriage as one person holding up the ceiling for a while and then being able to put his hands down and have the other person hold up the ceiling for a while. And it was sort of a simplistic but true way of capturing what marriage is like. You can't expect one person to be strong the whole time to take care of someone who happens to be going through a long, weak stretch. It's just too much to ask.
Next week on Modern Love, you know her as Piper Chapman in the hit Netflix series Orange is the New Black. Taylor Schilling reads a story about baggage.
The start of the date was flawless. He opened every door. He was inquisitive and polite. And I felt in my gut he was the rarest of things. A nice guy. And me? What was I? I wasn't even sure yet. Scott looked across the table and said, "So, I heard you were a slave in Asia. Is that true?" So much for getting to know me first.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. Additional sound design this week by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.